time to take questions, or I can go into detail on certain pieces of this.
Sure, and just for everybody in the audience, is this being represented like 307, or is this the first time this is being presented, SIP 306?
We have discussed it in the past, but I think it was with the previous council, if I remember correctly.
Sure. So just a refresher. Okay. Anybody have any questions for Noah?
Have there been any changes since the last time you presented it?
I mean, a lot has happened in the meantime, but I don't think any material changes have happened with the migration plan.
Yeah, if you look at the code history for the V3 market, for the legacy market, we pretty much haven't changed it since like December. And as far as things that have changed, we've probably changed a little bit our guidance on how to handle issues related to like the SNX rewards and stuff, because that's actually not an aspect that's managed by the legacy market. But I guess that could be a separate SIP entirely, to be honest. But yeah, that's really all that's evolved, I think, since then.
Yeah, to reiterate that, like really, the initial migration plan is intended to be like a soft launch and reduce risk as much as possible, and not rock the boat as much as we can. So, I imagine initially, like inflationary token rewards will remain on the V2 system. We can start bringing some collateral into the V3 system. Sort of on a more, let's say, experimental basis, and then we can explore ways to sort of expedite winding down V2 once we have other markets stood up on V3. Because initially, it doesn't really add anything to the system to be able to stake on V3 versus V2 directly, at least in terms of like network health or things like that. So this initial migration really is to just get the core system stood up, see that it's working, and then allow us to progressively sort of move things over.
So I have a couple of questions, please.
Yep.
So I've read in the SIP a section where there's an overview about the escrow synthetics that the SNX tokens that are held in escrow, they can't be. I didn't understand it really. So concept is that they can't be migrated, so they'll be redeemable for SNX. Is it the case, or is it something else? I didn't understand it really.
No. So the intent there is for existing escrow at SNX, that will get migrated over to the new system, and then basically a lock is applied on the account that tracks with whatever the escrow schedule is on the like related to the account on the V2 system. So the V3 system doesn't have a system for applying new locks or new escrow. We'll need to explore that separately, how we want to handle inflation on V3 or what that could look like. But the intent is that any like escrow type lock on a V2 account that will persist and be brought over to the V3 system.
So what do you mean by lock? Is it like, I don't know what's a lock.
Oh, I just it can't be withdrawn from the account. Like there's a check when you're pulling collateral out of the system, and if the yeah, if the amount of tokens haven't vested by that point, then you can't pull them out.
So it's like all your tokens get locked to the max state of your escrow. Is that how it works, or is it like tiered?
No. So literally every single, each account is going to consist of one or more escrow entries, right? So you might have
Sure.
like a 52 on average, maybe
Sure.
60 if you did some, So literally how V3 works, or how the legacy market works, is it iterates through every single one of those vesting entries, and it creates the same entry effectively on the V3 system. So it doesn't make any adjustments to the unlock schedule for the SNX in question. It still becomes unlocked at that date. It just gets converted to the V3 equivalent.
Okay, that makes sense. Now I understand what you meant by
However,
unlocking it. So it's unlocked on V2, but locked on V3.
It's effectively it's
Okay.
revoked on V2X. It would be worth noting, though, that this operation is pretty gas intensive. So if you have a particularly large account, like an account with a lot of nesting entries on it, on the UI, this should be handled automatically. But you're going to want to make sure that all of your vestible vesting entries are already vested, and then when you run the actual migration, we're talking you'll be paying maybe over 10 million gas if you've got lots of vesting entries. So just something to keep in mind. It is not a cheap process,
Sure.
migrating over to V3, but it's a lot better than paying for it ourselves.
Sure. But on optimism, it's kind of more okay,
Yeah,
right?
on optimism, it's not such a big deal, but on the for those L1 stakers, this is probably going to be a spendy migration.
Sure. But hopefully, we're looking at forcing some of them, right? Those that do not migrate themselves. Is it the case? Is there like a forced migration incorporated?
So there is a capability to force migrate accounts over to V3 in certain circumstances. But we're anticipating that this feature won't be used until later on when we're just trying to get like the last stragglers moved over and we really need the rest of the liquidity on V3.
So like when you migrate, you don't need to burn your debt to migrate. You can migrate even your debt is migrated over, or do you need to burn your debt?
You do not need to burn your debt. So how it works is it just transfers the debt shares over to the V3 legacy market contract, and then once it
Okay.
transfers the debt shares, your account becomes free to have its debt have the SNX moved into V3 basically, and then V3 assigns the same amount of debt to you once you get into V3. So, and that all happens as part of one transaction. So,
Awesome.
in general, you
And
don't need to unlock or do anything else. You can just call this function and you're migrated.
perfect. And from what I understand, the V3 system won't have like this cross-chain single debt pool, right? Or wrong? Like, will the Ethereum and Optimism V3 Spartan Council pools be unified via Chainlink, or is it like when I migrate? I don't know, how does it work like that?
Yeah, so it's kind of funny because when we first do the migration, like if there's no markup or anything on V3, V3 is basically like this really elaborate new staking thing. So it doesn't need to have any cross-chain capabilities. And so what we're going to do is we're going to continue using the cross-chain capabilities that are on the V2X side, which is that debt, the debt pool oracle and stuff like that. Now, as we migrate further over to V3, any liquidity that's officially on V3 at that point is not going to have any cross-chain capabilities, and and that's where some of the expected features for CCIP and the CCIP read oracle and stuff like that, those features are coming down the pipeline with our infrastructure providers. So we expect that the cross-chain matter with regards to V3 is going to be an issue that will come up in a future SIP. But initially, basically, we're just going to keep using the V2X system for sharing debt cross-chain, and V3 will gain the capability at a later date.
So wouldn't it like cause some problems potentially? Like, because I mean, I'm having a hard time kind of imagining it, because the debt, is like unified, is gonna be segregated. So I don't know, it doesn't like, it's not like pretty clear to me. Because let's say you have like $50 on L1 and like $100 on L2 worth of debt, and they migrate over. So what does migration entail? It entails that your debt shares are now on a different system as well as your collateral. But the SUSD, it's on a single that pool, the V2X, that pool, and it might not get distributed into both pools, you know, in a equivalent manner.
Well, I would, yeah, so the way I would think about this is, again, going back to that idea that this legacy market that's collectively backed by all the positions on V3 is sort of a single staker from the perspective of the V2 system. So if you're a staker on L1 and you migrate to the V3 system, then you're sort of part of this collective pool that's backing the system on L1, and that debt is socialized across chain, and then the same goes for L2.
So the debt pools are unified with V3.
Well, the V2 system debt continues to be unified cross chain. Yeah. It's when we start rolling out other markets on the V3 system, we're not set up to have the liquidity in the pools on the V3 side connected.
Okay.
Like in this diagram, in the SIP, it's like the left side is still connected top to bottom, but the right side isn't connected yet until we roll out a solution for that.
Okay. Like when you migrate to V3, you're still like kind of providing liquidity to V2 because you're not moving assets with you to V3. So that's how they're connected on the V2 system.
Exactly. Yeah.
Isn't that a bit complex as an operation?
Well, I mean, I don't know.
What do you mean as an operation? You mean the migrate operation?
I mean, like you have your assets on two different systems, you know, like the L1 and the L2 when it's on V3, and you have your debt shares on two different segregate, and you have like they're providing liquidity to markets in their own individual pools, but also they're providing liquidity to the legacy V2X pool. So it becomes like kind of spaghetti, you know?
I could make a diagram that makes it seem a little less spaghetti, but we're thinking sort of long-term where we want to be able to drop more liquidity into the V3 system from the V2 system without starting fresh there, but without like essentially rugging the collateralization of the debt issued by the V2 system. So the upside here, although there is a bit, there's definitely more complexity than just starting V3 fresh, but this migration plan allows us to pull collateral and existing debt obligations into the V3 system so that we can progressively wind it down over time.
I understand. There was like a question about if account merging is possible with the V3 system. Account merging is like when you move your escrow to a different account. On V3, does this exist?
Right,
I guess
now,
we go ahead, sorry.
Yeah, it doesn't exist right now, but basically accounts are just NFTs. So you could theoretically send the NFT to the same address. They're still
that's awesome.
Separate, but right, they're under the same ownership.
It's transferable, right? That's awesome. Okay.
Yes.
And that's it. You just move the NFT. And that technically moves the account. But
yeah,
you cannot combine the two NFTs into one NFT, right?
Not right now.
No, that's a feature we could add, but
sure.
Yeah, maybe, you know, the scope's already pretty big, so.
Sure. I don't know. It's fine. The issue is because of legacy wallets, you know, like if you want to move your assets to a different wallet, it's hard if it's without the merging. One last question, if possible. I don't want to hug all the time, but is the inflation, there was like some discussion in the SIP about how will incentivize the transition, and that's by switching off inflation on V2 and like moving it to V3? Is this the case?
That's what
That's
I would
yeah, go
anticipate.
ahead,
It's not specified by the currently discussed SIP, but that's the kind of thing I would think as we just move some of the inflation over. And that'd probably be, I mean, the other reason people might want to move over is just because they might want to be able to mint SNX USD and get maybe a favorable rate for arbitrage purposes or something like that. So there's other reasons why people might want to do the migration or be incentivized to do the migration.
Also, the performance of the V3, if the V3 markets start outperforming the P&L of the V2 system, then that's another natural incentive
Yes,
to liquidity.
exactly. Like over time, we expect the activity on V2X to wane, so there just won't be incentive to stay on V2X unless you're a fan of wasting opportunity to make money, I guess. So, yeah.
Sure. And the synth, they're like be completely different synths, because at some point I remember Afif spoke that there will be kind of the same synth. I don't know. Like SUSD will be SNX dollar, right? And so the old SUSD curve pool would be defunct, no?
Yeah, so we have a system for converting SUSD into the stable coin for V3, and I think we also added functionality for the reverse conversion, although we think there'll be an arbitrage opportunity that should keep the peg in line. I forget where we landed on that, but I should look at that. But yeah, the issue is basically that we need to differentiate the debt that's being issued by the V2 system from the debt that's being issued by the V3 system. So in the V3 system, the core really only issues the stable coin, and then the markets all issue other spot synths or perps positions or whatever. So the core system will have a way to convert the stable coins back and forth. If we want to come up with a conversion method for debt, not non-stable coin denominated system debt in V2 over to V3, that's something we could investigate, but that's sort of out of the purview of this SIP.
All right. Does anybody have any more questions?
Thank you. That's it from my side. Thank you for your answers.
Yeah, of course.
All right, if there are no more questions, I guess we can move on to SIP 307 for the V3 router proxy architecture. It does not look like we have Ethernet here, so.
I think
Sorry?
One more question. Is it ready for presentation on 307 for voting, or do you anticipate more changes to it? 306.
I think it's ready to go to vote. Maybe we can check in with the auditors just to confirm that they're not anticipating any material
Okay.
changes on their end.
All right. All right.
I'm pretty sure this is ready to go.
All right, we'll wait for your green light before setting up the necessary
Great.
vote.
Yeah, I'll make a note to sort that out.
All right, 307. Who's presenting it? Normally, Noah, you asked me to stage it today, no?
Yeah, I wasn't sure if Ethernet would be able to make it. It looks like he can't. I'm happy to speak to it, and DB can also fill in as well. He's pretty familiar with this. This is definitely more of a technical one, but has to do with the upgradability of the protocol. And so, basically, let's see. So the way this works is we have a proxy contract. Contract, a standard simple proxy contract that's owned by like governance by the and essentially this points at a router contract. The router contract is generated by like custom dev tooling automatically, and what this does is it points at it sees what function is being called by the proxy, and it finds the correct module contract to route that call into. And there are also storage contracts that you can almost think of like the database interface in the system. And so basically when we handle upgrades, what this will involve is basically we'll redeploy new modules if we've made any code changes within those modules. The tooling will regenerate this new router contract, which points at the whatever the new modules are that we've deployed. And then the proxy, and then once that sort of stood up, then we can have the proxy now point at the new router rather than the old one. And so this is sort of similar to the diamond pattern, but the major difference here, in as I see it at least, is rather than having the proxy sort of sort out where to send the function, we have this clear router contract, which is non-upgradable, and you can just you can see explicitly which modules are being used, and there's a little more, there's just a little more clarity, and the state of the proxy isn't really relevant to the current implementation of the system.
Yeah, sorry, go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to add that part of the advantages of this system, of course, practically Noah mentioned that it provides excellent upgradability support, allows for us to surpass contract limits and have very organized upgrades. But, Ethernaut, who was the one who kind of invented the system, is, he used to work at Open Zeppelin, and he knows a lot about the details of how smart contracts work. And there's a lot of optimizations that have been put into the thinking of how this proxy architecture should work. So a good example of this is if you're looking at the router, for example, it only has one function, which is the fallback function. And the benefit of this is that it means that there's this, I guess you could call it a data structure inside of the Solidity contracts, which basically determines which function to execute. And this actually adds quite a bit of gas usage as a baseline. And so with the router contract, we kind of skip that step. And instead, it literally is just calling directly into this single existing function. And it's the same way on the proxy. So we're able to get extremely efficient proxy functionality, minimal weight, and have a highly scalable protocol and modular protocol as well. So anyway, those are just my additions to that.
Yeah, definitely. And if you go to that,
is mostly a formality. I don't really know if this should be something that the Spartan Council is too concerned about, because it's more of an implementation detail than it is like an actual protocol functionality thing, but yeah.
I believe last time we presented this, the main concern was storage collision. And we will be falling back on usage of tools that were created for this purpose. Is this still the case, or is there another workaround?
That's right. Unfortunately, right now, Solidity doesn't provide any of the tools necessary to kind of ensure, I guess, that these storage collisions can't happen. But we've got tooling dedicated to solving this problem. And we also have a very defined storage setup, which is specifically designed to make storage easy to work with and to expose potential mistakes quite obviously.
Yeah, and I'd say also, if you just go into the Synthetics v3 repository and, for instance, go into the protocol folder and the Synthetics core code in there. I guess then you click into contracts. Okay, this became a longer path than I thought. But anyway, you'll see that there's a modules folder and a storage folder. And you can just sort of thumb through the code here to get a sense of the proxy architecture is enabling us to have this clean code encapsulation and setup where, yeah, there's no contract size limits. Essentially, we can just keep adding these modules. And then the story.
Very object oriented.
Like, yeah, it sort of feels like you're just doing like Ruby on Rails or like model view controller. Like it makes it a lot easier and cleaner to work.
So the question is from Troy, how do we make sure that these contracts, these upgrades don't break contracts? Like if you have a storage collision and you break a contract.
Yeah. So that's the tooling that DB had mentioned. This lives in the Synthetics V3 repo under utils/hardhat storage, I believe.
Right. And if there are no more questions, I guess before we move on to the next one, Noah, same. Is this ready for a vote or
are
you still waiting for feedback?
Yeah, this is definitely ready for vote. Yeah.
All right. That sounds good. Moving on to SIP 316. 316 is going to be presented by DB, Core System Precautionary Security Features.
All right. So we're maybe 1 to 2 weeks away. The audit's going to be ending this week for the V3 core system. And then we've got next week to correct any issues found with the audit. And then towards the end of the week, we expect that the V3 core system will be ready for deployment on mainnet. And as mentioned before, the deployment process is pretty easy. So we expect that will actually happen pretty quickly as well. With that in mind, I've sort of been looking forward towards, is there anything else we can do? You know, obviously V3 is a very, ambitious, approach in so many ways to building smart contracts and, decentralized finance systems. You know, how do we make sure that we are taking the necessary precautions to protect the protocol and prevent, massive loss of funds, basically? And so this SIP outlines some additional changes to the V3 system that have recently been implemented that will help protect the system. There's mostly just two specific changes that have been made. The first change is that we're introducing a withdraw timeout. For example, if you send money from any bank, at least in the US, there's almost always this delay time. And the part of the reason for this delay time is they need to validate all your transfers and stuff and make sure that you're not it's for safety reasons. And so this is for a relatively similar reason. So there's going to be a parameter which can be set via SCCP, which defines the number of seconds that must elapse between the last interaction with your account of some sort. So for example, maybe the last time you undelegated collateral, the last time you vested entries or something like that. There's got to be a time period between doing that operation and then subsequently withdrawing collateral from the system. And the reason we're putting this limitation right there is because, if there's some sort of a hack on V3, most types of hacks that we might run into would probably be relatively easy to resolve. I mean, I shouldn't say easy to resolve, but they will be resolvable. In contrast, if there's a major hack where some attacker is able to withdraw collateral from the system, we can't get that collateral back. It's lost forever. It's a difference between, just having to fix accounting issues and potential storage issues on the V3 system and being able to work through that process, or, just completely losing the assets and not being able to recover from that situation. So that's basically what's happening with the withdrawal timeout. It just puts a big gate, an extra check on perhaps the most sensitive operation on the entire system, just to make sure that if there's maybe an issue with the internal accounting with the system, or somebody finds a way to exploit, their account balances or something like that, we have time to react, and it can't just be like a flash loan attack and all of a sudden the protocol loses all of its money. So that's the first thing. The second thing that is being proposed is a addition of a system which is very similar to what we have on V2X. On V2X, we have like a contract called system status, which effectively allows for portions of the V2X system to be turned off by a core contributor or a member of the PDAO in the case that they find something that, you know, warrants the need for, you know, temporarily shutting down a portion of the protocol. So, for example, maybe, you know, we find a bug with issuance and it's actively being exploited. You know, it would be a good thing if we could just turn off that section of the protocol, you know, without having to go through the multi-sig or the normal, you know, PDAO process or the Spartan Council or whatever. You know, we can skip all of that and just have it be disabled if one person sees a problem. And so, yeah, just implementing that functionality on V3 is what is called for as part of 3.16. So how it works is every single function, almost every public-facing function on V3 has a feature flag added to it, and this feature flag can be disabled by a CC or a member of the PDAO or whoever the Spartan Council wants to delegate. It's part of the SCCP configurable options. And yeah, it basically just allows those people to disable any function in the system if there's, you know, a potential exploit in progress or something like that that's observed. So yeah, that's pretty much it. We think that this should provide a very nice, some extra layers of security to help prevent, you know, the worst from happening in the case of an attack or an exploit or something like that. It should also reduce the cost of, you know, payouts to for bug bounties, because like the severity of the bounties is probably gonna be a lot lower if, you know, you can't actually withdraw collateral from the system as easily.
Just one thing to add to help clarify here, that part of the design of the V3 system is that there's basically only two functions that allow collateral out of the system. There's a withdraw function for like stakers, depositors, LPs, whatever we're calling them. Yep. And then there's a function for markets to withdraw collateral, which is basically like, you can think of it as like for wrappers, like when you're unwrapping collateral.
So those are only for trusted markets, and the scope of that function is a lot narrower, so it's not a target of enforcement.
Yeah, exactly. So just to say that this, with the idea is also like, we have this like one single function that is the sort of gateway for getting collateral in and out. And that's where this, that's where the collateral lock that we were discussing earlier from escrow resides. That's where this gets enforced. And also notably, it's different than delegating to a pool. So like you could even, you could be in a situation where you can sort of undelegate from a pool. And then have that collateral sort of sitting in limbo, but it still can't get out the final gate. That sort of, it minimizes the impact on the branch functioning of the system.
All right, Caleb.
Thank you.
But
before we move on to questions, Adam couldn't be here. He had a question specifically about the withdrawal timeout. Wondering whether that would create friction for integrators running vaults or automated strategies, just for the recording, in case he's listening later. If you could address that concern, please, before we move on to questions from the rest of the council.
Yeah, it probably would create some friction in certain circumstances. But at the same time, it won't. How do I describe it? I guess the answer is yes, it does create friction, but it's also, this isn't anything super new. We've never actually had an integrator working specifically with staking, I don't think. And part of that is because we've, on staking of V2X, we've got a withdraw timeout, or not a withdraw timeout, we've got like a burn lock, basically, which prevents you from burning within like a week of minting. And so this is kind of similar to that. So would it impact integrators? Potentially, yes. But also, we are not aware of this being a target of integration, at least initially. And most likely this timeout is going to be relatively short. We're talking like in the on the order of hours, not like days. So hopefully that keeps the integrator burden to a minimum. You have something else to add, Noah?
No, yeah, I was just going to say, yeah, the whole SIP is also just mapping the V3 system closer to the functionality of V2. So the burn lock thing, I think, is worth mentioning.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe it's worth reiterating again that like you can still remove your delegation of collateral to a pool. You just can't get it completely out of the protocol while this is occurring. So the integrator would still be able to, interact in that way. It's just fully withdrawing there would need to be a delay.
Yeah. Also, there's technically a possibility in the future that we could tokenize our assets that are stored inside of the SNX system and allow for people to just trade them on the open market instead of waiting for the burn lock, if that's really a concern for integrators, and then it becomes an isolated problem.
Yeah, like your account NFT with the existing position
Yeah.
could still be transferred. So,
Anyway.
you can get really fancy with the integration if you want.
The point is we've got options, but we shouldn't let the worries of integrators that we've not heard of yet stop us from, trying to secure the system, I think.
Sure, thank you. Caleb or anybody else, floor is open for questions.
Oh yeah, hey, I just want to ask a question, DB. What's the rationale for this kind of protection, and what areas would it? I mean, it says core system security. Which areas would it really protect and kind of affect in the new V3 system?
Are you asking about both of the security measures that are described by the SIP?
I'm asking more about the deposit. I guess like a liquidate vault, and I think deposit market
Okay, so
collateral.
you're referring to the feature flags portion.
Yes.
Okay. Yeah, all those functions that are listed there are almost all of the public-facing functions for V3. So it allows so the logic is that we can selectively turn off any function on V3 by just calling that operation, calling the set deny all function basically.
Yeah.
So that's the logic.
And
It's basically all of the public-facing functions, except for a few. Like the only few that are not included are like, grant account, like things that are very specific to like specific accounts.
the goal of it's this, I think it's to say this flash loan and attacks.
No, that the flash loan attack is something that's so again, there's two separate security recommendations as part of this SIP. The one that prevents flash loan attacks is the withdrawal timeout.
Your timeout.
Yeah, it prevents like somebody from doing something in a flash loan and then just withdrawing collateral from the system somehow. They
Makes
get
sense.
stuck before withdrawing out of the system. But the feature flags, yeah, that doesn't do anything to prevent flash loans. It's very similar to system status on V2X.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense. I think where Adam's kind of question is coming from as well, from earlier, is like how would this affect the vaults with that withdrawal timeout? Want to maybe consider how this would affect in the future other integrators. Also, I think considering a lot of vaults give you a representation of your share of a token of what you have inside a vault. Like a share token that can then be used as collateral or lending on other platforms. I think that's a really useful pattern. So, you deposit some collateral, and then you get like a essentially like an LP token that then could be used on some lending markets, as collateral to, so if your collateral is just stuck in a vault at the moment, maybe it is a good thing to look at having
a token that a token that represents your collateral, so like an LP token, and then that can be used as to borrow against.
Yeah, that that is the account token.
That account token.
He's referring to a like an ERC-20, not an ERC, not an NFT.
Oh yeah. Yes, I was thinking more of an ERC-20 than an NFT.
Yeah, I think the problem is that the positions aren't fungible, right? Because you could have different amounts of debt associated with different amounts of collateral. So it would be a little more like a Uniswap LP token. And we do have that, yeah.
Yeah, I think we just need a little more time to see exactly how the ecosystem develops before we can kind of make decisions about what types of, tools we give integrators, like along the lines of what you're talking about, Jackson. Because right now, to be honest, it's hard to imagine exactly what
how that all works.
Ends up being, the needs of the market, I guess. It's kind of like, for me, it's like, I'm still like wondering, like, I don't know completely exactly how people are going to use Synthetix V3, because like we've kind of given it that flexibility to go in a lot of different directions. That's part of it.
Okay.
Yeah, but I got
the withdrawal lock is able to be turned off by just setting the withdraw timeout to zero, by the way. So if you really are super concerned about having this additional feature added, it can be turned off.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. That's all for me.
Awesome.
So from my side, would it be possible to lower it to zero to disable this lock?
Yes.
And is it configurable per liquidity
pool? No. It's literally just based on the last time somebody interacted with their account.
Yeah, I mean, no, the parameter. Is it a pool specific or a general protocol level parameter?
It's a protocol level parameter to protect withdrawals from the status proxy contract of collaterals, which we can't get back, basically.
Why wouldn't it be pool specific if, like, I set up my own pool and I just want no locks?
Well, it doesn't affect pools. This lock only affects withdrawal of collateral from the system. It doesn't affect, like, if you, for example, want to undelegate from one pool and delegate to another. That doesn't withdraw collateral from the system. That just moves it from one pool.
Absolutely.
To
another. Absolutely. Yeah. I'm just saying, like, if I set up my own segregated from the Spartan Council pool, asset pool. And I don't want to lock on it because I want to build an integration. You know what I mean? I want my pool providers, my liquidity pool providers, to have direct access to their money on my risk, you know?
Well, I think the issue is that it's not really pool specific on your own risk, because like all of the collateral is backing all of the stablecoin debt, and sort of by extension all the market debt. So I don't think you would actually be able to isolate the risk in that way.
Yeah, I don't know if I'm understanding the question that you're asking about right now.
Like if you set up a segregated set pool, you know, with its own markets,
yes.
and like I would have to adhere to the global parameter rather than I specify as a pool owner the parameters myself.
Yeah, this parameter doesn't have any effect on pools.
But it
affects accounts withdrawing collateral.
Sure, I mean it doesn't affect the pool itself, but it affects the users that provide the pool, because it adds friction to them being able to draw out their collateral, right?
That's correct.
Yeah, so that's what I mean, is that if I want to bear the risk as an owner, then why not? And the answer is because of the Go ahead.
Yeah, the issue is that you can't really bear the risk, because it's like the scenario this is designed for is like there's some sort of exploit or something, and someone's able to leak collateral out of the system.
Sure.
If they're able to leak collateral out of one particular pool that doesn't have this lock set immediately, that still impacts the broader like network collateralization, because again, like that is sort of a core property of Synthetics and Synthetics V3 is that we the stablecoin is like collectively backed by all of the collateral. So there, yes, the markets of that pool is backing could, I guess, get rugged faster if the accounting is still working in this exploit. But the broader thing is that the risk isn't contained. There are two functions. Like one is collateral moves in and out of the system. And then there's this second function, which is you're putting it in or out of the pool. And this lock applies to the former function.
Sure, that makes sense. Because if one of the pools gets rugged, the entire pool becomes under-collateralized and affects other pools. I was just thinking from the perspective of collateral-only perspective, like rather than also looking at the debt. Then, so the lock will kind of cause issues with integrators, obviously, but it is like, I think, more beneficial, especially for a new system, to have a lock.
The benefit is massive.
Yep. Sorry?
The security benefit is massive. Like,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah,
somebody withdrawing, you know, too much or basically profit stealing collateral from the system goes from being like critical to probably medium at best, because now, you know, you can't just flash loan the money out of the system. You'd have to wait, and it would be hopefully pretty obvious. You know.
Yeah, also, from the integrator standpoint, you could build integrations if you want to sort of move around ownership of the position. You would just be able to have a single position. You'd create a new account token for each of the positions you create. You could move that account token around freely, and then with the collateral inside of it, you could delegate or undelegate it from a pool. It's just if you want to go from account token back to collateral, you need to like wait a minute, basically.
So like one important thing to maybe bring forward is the fact that having this lock protection does not eliminate, it's only part of the story. The other part is like kind of finding out there's someone abusing before the timer runs out.
That's right.
And so,
but the severity, like, you know, it's definitely a lot worse to have an attack where, you know, everything is working as normal, and then the next block, everything, you know, all the money is taken out of the protocol versus,
yeah,
you know, some attacker had to do a lot of stuff in the system and potentially ruin the state of the system and make it obvious. And then 8 hours later, then they can finally withdraw, you know, so.
I agree with you. I understand the trade-offs perfectly well. What I'm saying is that we're relying maybe on human beings to kind of, not just in terms of notification. I don't know if there's like something that was thought out or designed that if someone triggers an action where it could lead to a catastrophic event, then I don't know, it blocks out, or I don't know.
Yeah, the main expectation is that, you know, there would probably be, we've got a lot of people in the community, a lot
yeah,
of course, you know, on-chain sleuths and stuff checking this stuff out. So, you know, the idea is that, you know, sure, someone from the team is going to find out that this is happening and realize that this is a potential, you know, a risk or an attack in progress on the system, and then we can stop it before it becomes permanent damage, basically.
Absolutely, yeah, I agree with that.
But give us that chance to be able to stop it, and
yeah,
the fact that there's chance at all will probably also reduce the potential the risk to reward ratio for a potential attacker as well. They'll be more likely to just report it as,
sure,
you know, an as a bounty for the system rather than try and exploit it themselves, because there's only a chance that their attack will be successful with this kind of a scheme.
Sure, of course.
Low, considering how many people are paying attention to on-chain statistics and keeping an eye out.
You'll be surprised how few, not how many. So my question is that, you know, like, how we built, like, kind of tooling for the storage overwrite, you know, with the proxy, the diamond proxy pattern. So my question is, if we have like some similar tooling that can be built for us, that can like simulate transaction and like kind of anticipate rugs and.
Yeah, I guess one thing you could theoretically do is, since the withdraw function is literally as simple as specifying an account ID and a amount to withdraw, you could, you know, have like a daemon which runs a test to see if you could theoretically withdraw, you know, you could check to see basically if everyone withdrew the maximum amount from the system, that amount is less than the total amount of collateral, I guess. Or something like that.
Yeah, like a fuzz
test. Again, that type of a system could potentially be gamed by an exploiter, depending on the severity of the exploit, too. So that's part of the reason why I'm not proposing any specific schemes to resolve that. I think it's just best to rely on, you know, I think part of one example of a good statistic might be like a dashboard on like Dune or something, which is basically showing like the total amount of assets that the system records that it has stored versus the total amount of assets that it actually has stored is a good example of one way we might be able to detect an attacker. But, you know, that's just one way, you know, again, if an attacker was clever, they might be able to find a way to work around that type of check. So it's just down to general purpose. Good reporting.
I would just hope that we have like tooling for notification that go hand in hand with the SIP so that it can be relied upon as part of infrastructure, you know, requirements. It would give us a lot more assurances about the lock being effective, because, you know, like these black hats, they're kind of smart, and if they're going to attack, they're going to attack on Christmas Day or something, like, you know, where there's not a lot of people watching the chain.
Maybe on a direct call or at some point later, we can get into more of the specifics and discuss what good like monitoring tooling might look like. But I think it's a great idea. I think it's sort of a separate project.
I mean, is the lock is going to be 8 hours, right? Or 6 hours, something like that?
I'm going to recommend initially it be set to 8 hours. Again, this is totally SCCP configurable. So
absolutely. Absolutely. And I believe this lock is only on withdrawing collateral. It does not affect withdrawing synth, right? Like when you trade a synth, you get it right away. You can do whatever with it.
Yep, synths are unaffected.
Sure. And it's only like external collateral. When it's being withdrawn, it gets locked at each interaction.
Yep.
Okay. Perfect. Yeah, that's it from my side. Thank you, everyone, for answering.
I have a general observation about this kind of time lock mechanism. So I've taken a look at similar kind of mechanisms on projects like GMX and stuff. And I've noticed that when time locks are kind of enforced at the account level, you have to be worried about like transferring the stake or the, you know, the claim to the account. Like if you were able to, for instance, transfer the stake value to some other account, that lock mechanism wouldn't be able to know that new account, I guess, had just recently deposited collateral. So that's something to keep in mind as well.
Yeah, right now there's no way to transfer collateral from one account to another.
Okay,
yeah, that's a good point. But yeah, if we implemented the like merge account functionality we were discussing before, that would definitely be an important thing to keep in mind.
Anybody else have any questions? All right, Tara did have one question in GovCall chat in the feature flags portion of this SIP. The last sentence, deniers are not permitted to reallow any feature without owner approval. Who's the owner being described there?
Yeah, sorry. The owner is a technical term for whoever's registered as the owner address of as V3 core system, and this will be the Spartan Council or the PDAO or whatever we have for ownership as of the launch of V3.
Sure. So his concern was that if it's the PDAO, they will be allowed kind of they'll be able to take action without governance approval. Is that a concern if the PDAO is the owner?
That's in nothing this
scenario.
All right. That's already been the case since the beginning of time, as far as I know.
So it's not necessarily that the PDAO will act without authority. It's whether they require authority to remove flags or not. Is it the intention that while the PDAO are still the owner, they're able to remove flags themselves, or is it the intended method that they go through the council in order to do so?
I'm not sure of the answer to that question because I didn't actually specify it in the SIP. I would recommend that it be the same as whatever we had in V2X for the system status. I don't know if that requires Spartan Council approval for re-enabling of features or not.
I guess my thinking on it is that while in emergency you have benefit from certain individuals being able to unilaterally pause functions in order to re-enable those functions, there's not necessarily the same time factor to be gained by bypassing governance.
I don't think that there's much gaming possibility unless the attacker is literally somebody within the PDAO.
No, it's not really. I'm thinking more of process.
Oh, okay. Yeah, this process hasn't been specified by this SIP.
Yeah, I would think about this as analogous to the system status functionality in V2 as much as possible.
I don't know if it says in the system status whether or not the PDAO can enable without oversight or not.
I think we cannot.
Right.
PDAO historically cannot enable something that has been suspended. There are like very, very, very narrow. Normally, it's only by PDAO, I mean the contract, they can enable, but like the PDAO signers, they cannot sign resume transactions. That said, there are exceptions, of course, certainly pertaining to the circuit breakers that we have that can resume and like the market being down, circuit breaker. That and few others like exceptions like that, but owners of the PDAO contract cannot resume.
In my opinion, that norm should be maintained. And so if it could be added to the SIP, or if we could consider adding it to the SIP, I'd appreciate it.
Sure thing. I will add that precedent to the SIP for just to make sure that it's clear.
Thanks, DB.
Great. So it sounds like we have one SIP ready for a vote, one SIP waiting for feedback from the auditors, and one SIP waiting for a minor correction from DB before going to a vote. Is that correct?
yeah, I'll get back to you on that in the next couple of days.
Great. And DB316 is ready for a vote pending this correction?
Yes. I'm just going to add a line underneath where Tara mentioned, just to confirm that detail in, like, within the next minute or two.
Perfect. Okay. I guess, Caleb, you set up those two votes then, right?
And sure, I'll do it. I'll do it. No worries.
Call it a night then. I guess that's a wrap for tonight. Thank you, everybody, for being here.
Thank you, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Thank you.